All right, this is Baptist Basics University course, The Gospel of John. I'm Matthew Gage. This is lesson number 9, and today's lesson will deal with the woman at the well. We'll be in John chapter 4, verses 1 through 42. Got quite a bit of ground to cover in this lesson, so hold on. In fact, when I use these notes to teach my Sunday school class, we didn't quite get done, so hopefully we don't have that problem here. Apologize if there's a little bit of a change in the sound there. I'm kind of tweaking with the sound just a hair. I think I may have turned down a little too much. Let's turn back up. Sorry to waste your time on that. Anyway, John chapter 4, we have Jesus talking with the woman at the well. It's the major portion of this. Now, the last chapter we dealt with, chapter 3, we had his conversation with Nicodemus. So, two straight chapters here, we have Christ talking at length with individuals. Now, Christ did spend a lot of time talking to multitudes and preaching and teaching, but he still took time to speak individually with people to help them, to reach them, to win them. And this is what's going to happen here. Now, this is very interesting. Chapter 3 with Nicodemus, of course, Nicodemus sought out Christ and came to him by night and had a chance to talk with him one-on-one. In this case, from the language of the first few verses, Christ went out seeking this woman. Christ went out of his way to be able to talk with this lady and for a purpose, to win her, but also to win her town for Christ. And we'll deal with some of the history and stuff, kind of some interesting stuff there. But you have to remember that Christ's mission was to seek and to save that which is lost. That was his mission. Not only was it to come and die for our sins on the cross, but it was also to reach lost people while he was here. And the Gospels are filled with stories, whether it be Nicodemus or the Samaritan woman, or maybe the rich young ruler, or the centurion. I don't think he called him a centurion. I've gone blank though, but. You know, blind people and lepers and just so many stories how Christ would go out of his way to reach individuals. That's what Christ came to seek and to save that which was lost, not just as a group, but as individuals. Just as Jesus cares for each of us individually, Jesus Christ cared for those people he encountered on an individual basis. And that's what we're going to deal with in the stories. Another example of Christ reaching someone and saving them. And this is really a neat story to me, because you also see the impact of just that reaching one person. Sometimes we lose sight of the importance of winning people individually. We get wrapped up in numbers and we want to win a bunch of people, or we want to do great things. Well, Christ took his time to talk to one lady and ended up evidently winning almost an entire village to him. Now, let's look at the setting of this. Looks like, according to the first two chapters here, verse 1, when therefore the Lord knew how the Pharisees had heard that Jesus made and baptized more disciples than John, and then, let's look at that first. And what we see here is that Christ is gaining a lot of popularity, and as his popularity has grown, so has the opposition to it. So the Pharisees, which are the most powerful religious group in Israel, and even politically extremely powerful, they are beginning to take note of Jesus. They're beginning to take note of his ministry and what's going on. And that's not necessarily a good thing. They're jealous of him. And comparing this to other passages in the Gospels, it's very likely that this attention gained by the Pharisees was also leading to plots to have him killed. There are a couple places in the Gospels that talk about the Pharisees' plans to kill him. And that's probably what is going on here. And now verse 2 talks about, though Jesus himself baptized not, but his disciples. What is that talking about? When people came to be baptized by Christ, which we talked about in the last lesson a little bit, he himself did not baptize them. His disciples did the baptizing. So, you know, if it's called the baptism of Christ, which we kind of had that that set up in the last lesson, we had the baptism of Christ and baptism of John. It wasn't Christ who baptized the people, it was his disciples. And we'll see in verse 3, he left Judea and departed again into Galilee. And verse 4, and he must needs go through Samaria. Tell you what, let's go ahead and we'll read chapter or verse 5 too, and then we'll talk a little bit about this setting. Then cometh he to a city of Samaria, which is called Sychar, near to the parcel of ground that Jacob gave to his son Joseph. So what's happening? Christ is departing Judea, the area around Jerusalem, Bethany, Bethlehem, all those places down in the southern part of Israel. And the southern part as in like if to the west of the Dead Sea, that region down there around Jerusalem. He's going to leave that area because there is a growing opposition to him, evidently, based on the first couple verses there. And so he's going to go to Galilee. Now, Galilee's up by the Sea of Galilee. If you can picture in your mind, I always like to draw this on the board. Actually, now I've got a map in my classroom. I don't have to. I just kind of I've got it laminated so I can write on it. But you can imagine you've got the Sea of Galilee up the top and draw a little squiggly line going down. That's the Jordan River, and then draw another little lake down there, and that's the Dead Sea. And you can place a lot of stuff in Israel based on that. Well, Judea is all that down to the west of the west of the Dead Sea, and then going up the Jordan River to its source up at the Sea of Galilee. That region up there around that, and most specifically to the west of it, was called Galilee. So he's going from the southern part kind of to the northern part of Israel, and in between Judea and Galilee is a region called Samaria. And Samaria is a very interesting place. There's been some studies and stuff put onto it, so I'm going to try to briefly describe kind of what went on with this. Samaria is this region that is, it's west of the Jordan River, and it is in between Judea and Galilee. Now, the people inhabitants here, well, let me go back just a little bit here. This region was the key region with the split of the northern and southern kingdoms. After the death of Solomon, Rehoboam, his son, took the throne, ends up through his ill-conceived and plans, ends up leading to a kind of a civil war in the kingdom. And then the kingdom of Israel splits into a northern and southern kingdom, the southern kingdom being called Judea, the northern kingdom being called Israel. Now, that northern kingdom would end up being, of course, Samaria. And that's where this all gets its regions. Well, the key thing to know when you're getting into New Testament times about Samaria is that the people there were not full-blood Jews. Evidently, what had happened is in 722 BC, the Assyrian army came and conquered that northern kingdom of Israel. And Assyria did something very interesting, especially for ancient kingdoms. Usually when they came in, they would just kill everybody or take them all as slaves, and that's how they would put people under control. Assyria had a very different idea. What they would do is come in and take a lot of people captive and then move them to new areas. The way that they had envisioned this is that people, once you took them away from their homes and away from their homeland and put them in a strange land, that they would be less likely to fight, less likely to raise up in civil war. Now, the Assyrians were very cruel, very, very mean. History bears that out. But this was something that they did, which is surprising because normally you'd think somebody had a reputation for being very cruel would just, kill everybody. But they didn't do that. This is one of the principal things they did, was kind of move people around. And what happened is there was, of course, some people of Jewish blood left in the region of Samaria after it was conquered by Assyria. And these people intermarried with some of the, Gentiles, you could call them, that had moved in there. So what ends up happening is that When we fast forward to the New Testament times, to the time of Christ, Samaria is populated by a bunch of people who are half Jew, half Gentile by blood. And, of course, you know, what are they? Are they Jewish? Are they Gentile? Are they pagan? What are they? Well, they themselves kind of came up with their own identity. They had their own hybrid religion that they even practiced, which in fact dates all the way back to the split of the kingdom, but it really took its shape after the Assyrian conquest, because what happened is their religion kind of was a hybrid form of the Jewish religion and different elements of paganism, and they kind of morphed together to make a new religion. And what they did, instead of worshiping at Jerusalem, they would worship at Mount Gerizim, and that was a place that had a temple built there that was destroyed years later, but that they had this temple there. That's where they worshiped. In fact, if you want to do some stuff, it's kind of interesting, a little bit strange, but they even have their own kind of version of the Jewish law that they still kind of keep. Honestly, if you kind of see a picture of them, the people who, there's still few people, not a lot. One of the things I looked at said there's only maybe like 700 people, but there's still a few people in the area that actually still practice this religion to this day. And they kind of look like Jews. They have their own Pentateuch. They have their own, they even have their own version of the Ten Commandments, which is slightly different. In fact, their Tenth Commandment is something about keeping Mount Gerizim holy. It's very strange. So they had this different religion. In fact, just another little side note that's not in the notes, when Vespasian came and the Romans came to finally quell the Jewish revolt, and that has finale in 70 AD. This was a few years before that, but when they got to the region of Samaria, the Samarians tried to say, hey, we're sorry, we're not Jews, we're not revolting. But Vespasian looked at them and said, well, you look just like them, let's conquer them too. So they kind of got lumped in with the Jews. It's a very small population, and they were very similar in a lot of aspects to the Jews, even in their religion. But what happened is the Jews hated the Samaritans. They saw them as half-breeds. They saw them as heretics. They hated the Jews. There was practically no communication there. In fact, when with the Roman division of the kingdoms and stuff, this was its own little place. They kind of had to govern it separate from all the areas that had Jewish populations. And the Jews would not, they would keep from going. If you had a very pious Jew at this time who wanted to go from Jerusalem to, say, Capernaum in Galilee, they would actually, instead of going the straight line, they would actually go out of their way and go around Samaria, even to the point of going to the east part of the Jordan River. They just would not even go through there. They hated these people. They hated their religion. They, it is just a very, kind of really a very bad and disappointing situation that there was in. But that's just the way it was. The Jews and Samaritans hated each other. Now, this story in verse 5, you'll see it takes place at a place called Sychar. Now, Sychar, originally the name of the place was Shechem. It was the first capital of the northern kingdom. That's about 930 BC when the kingdom split. This place actually was the first capital of the kingdom of Israel after the northern kingdom split. Now, the name, in fact, the name, there's actually, it's spelled a little differently. It escapes me now. In the book of Acts, it talks about this place too, and it's spelled a little bit differently. It actually resembles, I want to say it's Sychem or something like that, but I don't remember exactly. Don't hold me to that. But, so this place has been around for a long time. In fact, there's three key things about this place that, historically, other than being the first kingdom of the capital of the northern kingdom, there's three things that are there that are kind of key to history. The first is, this is where Mount Gerizim is. That place that the Samaritans worshipped, that's right outside this town. So when Christ is here talking to this lady, they are practically in the shadow of Mount Gerizim, where the Samaritans practice their religion. Now, by this time, Sychar is now a village. It's not a capital city, but this still was a key city for the Samaritan religion, those that still chose to practice it, which was not a whole lot of people at this time. So the Mount Gerizim's right there. The second thing is Jacob's Well, which, of course, we see here in this passage. That's where this takes place, is Jacob's Well. This evidently, traditionally, is a well that Jacob dug all the way back in the book of Genesis. And even today, this well is still there. There is a big church building, like I think it's a Greek Orthodox church, built on top of it. That's the way they do things, kind of the Catholic thing. You find some place that they think, quote unquote, is a holy place, and they build a big church on top of it, and you have to go down the basement to see the holy site. And that's kind of the way it is, and you can look it up on the internet. But you can go down into a vault underneath this big cathedral, and you can still see Jacob's Well, which, by the way, just interesting notes, according to travelers and stuff from years ago, that well was about 7.5 foot wide and went down to somewhere like I want to say it was about 100 feet deep, something like that. So, I mean, it's a pretty deep well, pretty big well when you look at it, especially to be hand-dug like that. And the third thing that's kind of interesting to know about this place is that this is the location of Joseph's tomb. And that's something else you can go today, and they've kind of built a new little building over it in the past few years. But traditionally, this is the place of Joseph's tomb, and this is a tourist kind of site even to this day. You can go there, and supposedly Joseph's body is buried in this one vault in there. Now, of course, a lot of that kind of stuff you kind of have to take with a grain of salt, because, it's hard to trace exactly, is this really Joseph's tomb? Is this really the well Jacob dug? We have to kind of base it on tradition, and, could these things be? Very likely. I mean, it is very likely these are the things, but even if they're not, they are pretty doggone close to them. So at least you're in the right area. But as I say, some of these things have been passed down for 2,000 years, even in the names of the places and stuff. And you got to think, too, even when the Jews, the Jews would end up losing control of Palestine, in that region, but then the Muslims didn't gain control of it until 600 or 700 AD, something like that. So in the Muslims revered people even like Jacob and Joseph to an extent. So they kind of kept the sites holy also. So that's enough setting this up. We've got a whole bunch, about 36 verses to get through, and we'll just kind of deal topically with what's going on, hit a few high points. Let's just jump in this, because we've got quite a bit to get to, and I'm sure you really don't want to listen to another hour of me going through this. I've already gone, looks like, about 18 minutes on it. And I did not finish this lesson in my Sunday school class, so hopefully we'll make a little bit better time when we can get this wrapped up. Without sacrificing anything, by the way. We'll try to cover all the high points. So let's jump back in here. Verse 6. Now Jacob's well was there. Jesus, therefore, being wearied with his journey, sat thus on the well, and it was about the sixth hour. So what's happened is Jesus and disciples are passing through here. He must needs go through Samaria. They come to this town. Of course, now you got to think that the disciples are probably not very happy about going through here, just with the animosity between the Jews and the Samaritans. So they get there. Jesus is tired. The sixth hour most likely refers to it being about noontime. It could also, maybe some people think it may mean that this is like a supper time. It could be getting late in the evening. But most people believe that this, it depends on what the sixth hour is from, but most people that I've read believe that this was at noontime. And Jesus comes, he's tired, he's going to stop and wait by the well while his disciples go into the town to try to find some food. Now, as I say, this is a very deep well, and they didn't just leave, an old bucket and rope and stuff out there. When people went to go draw water, they brought their own buckets and own ropes and stuff. So Jesus is sitting there at this well, and there's no way for him to get a drink. So verse 7, then cometh a woman of Samaria to draw water. Jesus saith unto her, give me to drink. So we see here comes this lady who is going to come draw water. Now, this is unusual in that traditionally what would happen is the women would come in the morning to get the water they need for the day, come in the cool of the morning and draw the water. Because, I mean, this is difficult work, and especially when you think about how much water they would have to carry and draw from that well, they would do it in the morning when it was cool. Well, here it is in the middle of the day. It's hot. You know, the sun's beating down on them, and here comes a woman to draw water. This is very unusual. What this probably signifies is that she was an outcast. She wasn't quote unquote allowed to go draw water with the respectable women of the town. So already we know something is a little bit peculiar with this woman's story. Verse 8, for his disciples were gone away unto the city to buy meat. We've already kind of discussed that. And verse 9, I always think about that. I heard a preacher one time say they went into town to go to McDonald's and buy Happy Meals. And that every time I read this, I remember that. I got another joke I'll tell you a little bit later on based on this. It may have been the same guy. But anyway, verse 9, then saith the woman of Samaria, how is it that thou, being a Jew, askest drink of me, which am a woman of Samaria? For the Jews have no dealings with the Samaritans. So right here, the woman is surprised, shocked, flabbergasted at this request that Christ has made. Why? Because the Jews and the Samaritans just flat didn't talk. They rarely encountered each other, and which even in the case of like the Good Samaritan makes that story even more profound, is that the Samaritan would help the poor Jew that had been attacked by robbers, because the Jews and Samaritans hated each other. It went both ways. It wasn't just the Jews hated them. The Samaritans hated the Jews. And so here is this Jewish man who asks this Samaritan woman to for a drink of water. And the woman says, oh my goodness, I don't understand. Why are you asking me? I can't believe this, because we're not on good relations. We don't talk. You know, listen, when y'all go travel through here, y'all don't even come by where we live. Y'all completely avoid it. So she is really shocked at this. So verse 10, Jesus answered and said unto her, if thou knewest the gift of God, and who it is that saith to thee, give me to drink, thou wouldest have asked of me, and he would have given thee living water. So Christ is going to turn the conversation to something spiritual. He's got her attention just by asking her for a drink of water in the first place, and now she is going to turn this conversation into something spiritual. That's what he's beginning to do here. And, of course, now, this is something Christ would do quite often. You know, of course, even in the parables, he would take a very common thing that people would know about and then put a spiritual meaning behind it. And so Christ is taking her, talking about water and using it as a kind of a representation of salvation. And that's what I was saying. He said, if you would ask me, I could give you living water, which would be, living water is in salvation. Now, living water, I throw this into you as far as Bible customs and stuff go, that phrase living water can also mean water from a spring, water that's moving like that. So that they actually would call that living water. So Jesus may be further even here trying to get her attention by saying, hey, if you were to ask me, you wouldn't have to draw water from this well. I can show you where there's living water. So he's going to get her attention. So verse 11, we'll see verse 11, 12, the woman does not get what's going on, which is the way most people are with spiritual things. The woman saith unto him, sir, thou hast nothing to draw with, and the well is deep. From whence then hast thou that living water? Art thou greater than our father Jacob, which gave us this well and drank thereof himself and his children and his cattle? So the lady says, now, wait just a second. How are you going to give me water? You don't have a bucket. You ain't got a rope. There's no springs around here. where in the world are you going to get water from? And who do you think? And then who do you think you are? Are you better than Jacob? Jacob is legendary. Everybody knows about Jacob. Abraham, Isaac, Jacob. Everybody knows about them. Are you saying you're better than Jacob? How dare you? Jacob was a great guy. And I don't even know who you are. So the woman is very puzzled at his request, puzzled at who's at the request and even who's asking him. Like, why in the world is this guy telling me this? I don't get it. Who does he think he is? So verse 13, Christ is going to turn the conversation back to spiritual things. Jesus answered and said unto her, whosoever drinketh this water shall thirst again. Talking about the water from the well. So if you drink this water, you're going to get thirsty again. But whosoever drinketh the water that I shall give him shall never thirst. But the water that I shall give him shall be in him a well of water springing up into everlasting life. So Jesus here is taking salvation and explaining it through very common, understandable, earthly terms. He's comparing it to water. He's saying that if you drink the water of this world, you're going to thirst again. It does not satisfy. But if you drink the water, drink the salvation of Christ, if you partake of that, then you're never going to thirst again because it completely satisfies. You need nothing else. It's once you do it, it eliminates all need for further salvation. So that's what's being talked about there. And not only that, but we, once we partake of that water of salvation, that we become wells of water up ourselves, and that we can then, you know, give this water to the people. That's kind of the figure that's kind of being spoken of here. So he's got her attention now. Hey, water, I drink it and I don't get thirsty again. This is great. I'm tired of drawing water from the well. So verse 15, the woman saith unto him, sir, give me this water that I thirst not, neither come hither to draw. So, hey, this is a good deal. I'm tired of coming out here by myself and having to throw my bucket down there and haul up that water and haul it back to town. If you can give me water I don't thirst again, I'm all for it because I'm tired of doing this work. So verse 16, Jesus is about to nail her to the wall right here. Jesus saith unto her, go, call thy husband and come hither. See, Jesus, in his omnipotence, knew who this woman was and knew she had needs. And it was far greater than just needing to get water from the well. She needed salvation. She was like us, was a sinner. The 4 points of salvation is that we must know we're a sinner. We must know Christ died for our sin. We must know that we're sinners. We must know there's a punishment for that sin. We must know that that Jesus paid the price for sin so that we can, through our faith, believe in him and receive eternal life. So he's already kind of tried to explain figuratively salvation to her, but this woman doesn't get that she needs salvation. She doesn't get that yet. She's still thinking in terms of the practical and thinking, hey, I don't want to drink. If I can get this water and I have thirst again, I want that. Well, Jesus is about to really show her that she needs more than water, that she needs a Savior. And that's what he does right here. Go call thy husband and come hither. And in verse 17, she's going to admit it. The woman answered and said, I have no husband. And Jesus said to her, thou hast well said, I have no husband. Jesus said, you're exactly right. You don't have a husband. Verse 18, continuing, for thou hast had five husbands, and he whom thou now hast is not thy husband, and that thou saidst thou truly. That saidst thou truly. Sorry, I keep jumbling my words a little bit. And so I said, wait a minute, yeah, you're exactly right. You've been married five times, and you're living with a guy right now you're not even married to. Now, in most cultures, that's taboo, and especially in the Jewish culture, that was taboo. And in the Samaritan culture, that was also taboo. So that's where you see this woman is an outcast in town because she is not the most chaste individual. Now, it's not the sin of divorce necessarily. I mean, it's that there's a lifestyle that goes along. There's a reason why this lady's been married five times. She's probably a, honestly, just to be flat brutal, she's very likely some type of like prostitute. She is not a clean person by any means, and which then we think, oh my goodness, why then would Jesus talk to such a woman? You know why? Because Jesus came to seek and save that which was lost. And you know what? This lady knew she was lost. Once Jesus gets done here, it's going to click inside of her, and she's going to say, oh my goodness, you know, who am I? And who is this talking to me? You know, until we realize we're sinners, Christ can't do anything to us. Christ can't save us until we realize we're sinners. Some people, it takes them a long time to come to that point to realize, oh my goodness, I am a filthy, rotten sinner, and I need God. Whether it be stories like Billy Sunday, who was carousing with his baseball buddies and heard the music at the Pacific Mission Garden and got up and went there and turned his life around. You know, he ended up having to experience some of the depths of sin to the point that God could use him. I think of Sam Jones, the old Methodist evangelist, a similar deal. It took him begging for one last glass of liquor and then looking in the mirror and thinking, oh my goodness, what has become of the once great Sam Jones, who was once one of the great lawyers in this area, and took that for him to finally turn around. They had to see that sin before they do it. And we have to see ourselves a sinner and see our sins before Christ can use us, because it's not about us. It's about God working through us. And you have to kind of keep in mind that who we are. You know, we're just human flesh. We're prone to mistake. We're prone to wonder. We're prone to we're prone to fall short of the glory of God. But when we realize that and we admit it, that's when God can work through us. Not just in salvation, but when we realize our own shortcomings is when God can do a work through us as Christians also. Not to get too far ahead of ourselves. Well, I got to rambling on that. Let's see, where were we? Verse 19, the woman saith unto him, Sir, I perceive that thou art a prophet. Well, she's on to something now. So there's something a little bit different about this guy. It says, excuse me, sir, are you a prophet? This is very strange. How in the world would you know that? Because he ain't from around these parts. How would he know about this Samaritan woman? But he did. Verse 20, our fathers worshipped in this mountain, and ye say that in Jerusalem is the place where men ought to worship. So here she goes. Oh, she says, I get it now. You're a prophet. You're one of those Jews. You've come up here to remind us that we're supposed to worship in Jerusalem and not in Mount Gerizim. You've come up here to rehash that old debate. I see where this is going. I should have known that you're not trying to be nice to me. You're trying to just put one over on us poor, dumb Samaritans again. I think I've got this figured out now. Verse 21, Jesus saith unto her, Woman, believe me, the hour cometh when ye shall neither in this mountain nor yet at Jerusalem worship the Father. Now, listen, this is a key point in Christ's message. Get this in the next few verses. Ye worship ye know not what. We know what we worship, for salvation is of the Jews. Now, he is correct here. He's saying there's going to come a day, it doesn't matter where you worship. There's not going to be a temple. There's not going to be a centralized religion. And then he even says, salvation is of the Jews. How do we have salvation? Because there was a Jewish nation. God called a man named Abraham, made a great nation of his descendants. And from that, you know, fast forward a few thousand years to the point that Christ would come to the Jews. He would be a Jew of the Jews to the Jews, and then he would die for us. How could we know salvation? It was because of the Jews. How could we know God? We know God because God revealed himself to the Jewish people. So salvation is of the Jews. That's a good point right there. So now we're going to see what is the true way to worship God here in verses 23 and 24. But the hour cometh, and now is, when the true worshipers shall worship the Father in spirit and in truth, and the Father seeketh such to worship him. God is a spirit, and they that worship him must worship him in spirit and in truth. Now this is a key thing. This is something the rabbis were not saying. They were saying, just like this woman thought, you know, that they were defending their Judaism. They were defending Jerusalem. They were defending the temple. They were defending the Jewish practices and the law and the traditions. Jesus says, you can throw all that out the window. It's not about how close you keep the law. It's not about the sacrifices. what it is, it's between you and God, and it's in spirit and in truth. That is a tremendous concept. And this is something, I'll tell you, you want to talk about one of the key points of Christianity. You can be a Christian anywhere in this world. You don't have to be somewhere. If you're a Muslim, you know, you're still supposed to go and make those pilgrimages. If you are a Buddhist, then you really, to be close to Buddha and what he did, you need to be over in Asia. Most religions are localized. That's just fact. But here's a point where this is no longer... Salvation is about to come to the whole world through the work of Christ. And people throughout the world will be able to worship God in spirit and in truth at any location. Because it's not about where you are, it's about who you are. It's about your relationship with Christ. It says the Father seeketh such to work with him, worship him. He's not seeking for people to debate and rehash all that old stuff. He's looking for people that will serve and worship him. Verse 24, God is a spirit. They that worship him must worship him in spirit and truth. How do we worship God? It's not in the things that we do necessarily. That's a byproduct of who we are on the inside. But sometimes we get wrapped up in just making ourselves look good. Well, God sees past all that. He sees our hearts. And when we serve God from a heart, that's when he's talking about serving him in spirit and in truth. Now, I like that this spirit and truth, by the way, some people neglect either one. You got to have the balance of the two. There's some people that worship God in spirit. They catch the spirit of Christ's love, the spirit of Christ's devotion to reaching the lost, yet they sacrifice God's truth to do it. Then there are some people who are all about the truth and the doctrines and the teaching of God's word, yet they lose the spirit of evangelism, the spirit of giving and such things. We've got to have both. We have to have the heart and the mind. We have to stand for truth, but we need to put that truth to practice. That's what's kind of being taught right there. Spirit and in truth. That's key to become Christian. It's not just about the truth, but you need the truth. It's not just about the spirit, but you need the spirit, but you need both. If you get too far on either one, you're wrong. You're setting yourself up for disaster. You're setting yourself up for false doctrine come in. I tell you, this is one of the problems I have with Calvinism. They went so far into the truth end that they found stuff that wasn't truth. And they lost the spirit. They lost the spirit of evangelism. Now, there's other groups. Let's take, for instance, the Salvation Army. They were all about the spirit. All about let's win people to Christ. Doesn't matter. But they neglected truth. They set up an organization that was not biblical. They ended up falling into, false doctrines of holiness and such were being propagated through the Salvation Army. It wasn't that people weren't getting saved. It's just that there was problems in the truth in things once they did. And now the Salvation Army, what is it? Well, there's still a few little Salvation Army churches, but mostly it's a charitable organization now, and you know they run thrift stores. That's about all you think of now, and the little kettles in front of Walmart at Christmas time. At one time, the Salvation Army, they'd come into town, they'd bring a brass band and go marching up and lead everybody, get a big crowd and go into a meeting house or a hall somewhere and have somebody preach the gospel and would have hundreds of people saved and really reach those the downtrodden and the wretched sinners of the day. I tell you, it's very interesting. I'll tell you a good book to kind of read on that is if you can find the book, there's a biography about Harry Ironside. And he was involved in some of that movement back in the early days. Very good. Kind of give you an idea of that. And then he himself ended up kind of getting caught up into some false holiness and perfectionism doctrines and kind of had to come to his senses on that. But if you want to kind of get a glimpse into that, I would recommend you track down, I can't remember what the name of that book is, but there's not very many books about Harry Ironside. So if you can track that down, you can read a little bit more about that. But you must worship God in spirit and truth. Let's get going here. We keep this lesson from rambling too much longer. We still got long ways to go. So verse 25. The woman saith unto him, I know that Messiah cometh, which is called the Christ, when he has come, he will tell us all things. So the woman, I think, is beginning to catch on as to who's talking to her. This guy isn't preaching Judaism, but there's something special about him. And she says, anyway, I know that there's a Messiah coming, and he's going to set all this stuff straight. In verse 26, this is a great verse right here. You won't talk to somebody and say, oh, Jesus was a great teacher. He never claimed to be God, never claimed to be anything. Verse 26, Jesus saith unto her, I that speak unto thee am he. He says point blank, I am the Messiah. I am the Christ. I am that person that was foretold all the way back in the Old Testament. Jesus said, I am he. That is key. I tell you what, you ought to underline that and right there. Jesus said, I am the Messiah. Very, very key verse there. There's people even today that doubt, they'll say Jesus was a great teacher, but his disciples deified him after he was dead, and they, you know, you get into all that Da Vinci Code garbage where, they kind of formulated this own Christian thing. No, that's not the case. Jesus Christ was the Messiah. He knew he was the Messiah. He was the Messiah. He proclaimed he was the Messiah. Verse 26, he said, I am he. Verse 27 now, we got a new paragraph here. So we, I don't know if your Bible has a paragraph mark. It's kind of a helpful thing to study and kind of keep your thoughts. So verse 27, we have the disciples coming back. So we kind of have a break from the conversation. Jesus has proclaimed, told her point blank who he is. And right about this time, of course, here come the disciples. And verse 27, and upon this came his disciples and marveled that he talked with the woman. Yet no man said, what seekest thou, or why talkest thou with her? So disciples come up and they kind of look at each other like, hey, what's Jesus talking to a Samaritan woman for? What's the deal with this? But nobody had the guts to go up to him and say, hey, Jesus, why are you talking to her? What's the deal here? What's going on? They just kind of cut their eyes at each other, did a little murmuring, and said, what in the world's going on here? This is a key thing with the disciples to remember. The disciples usually don't get it. The disciples, a lot of times in the Gospels, they are kind of like the Three Stooges times four, okay? They don't get it. It takes them a little while. They're slow of learning. They're kind of like we are. It takes us a little bit sometimes to catch on. So that's what happens here. The disciples just don't get what's going on here, but Jesus is going to have to teach them. That's kind of a key thing in this passage too. Jesus is going to explain to them what's going on, okay? Verse 28. The woman then left her water pot and went her way into the city and saith to the men, come, see a man which told me all the things that I ever did. Is not this the Christ? Then they went out of the city and came unto him. So the woman, so the disciples come, she leaves, she goes back and says, hey, everybody, look, I found a man that said, told me everything I ever did. And that got people's attention. Now, there's something key here. She talked to the men. She didn't talk to the ladies. That probably shows how much she was shunned by the ladies. But also, most people think that she was somewhat of like a prostitute. And if that's the case, when she told the men, hey, come see this man that told me everything I did, all those men thought, oh boy, what does he know? Does he know that? So that's probably had a little conviction going on there. So all the men take off, and they're going to go see about this guy that told her everything. So here we go, verse 31. I got a little note point there on letter Q. We'll talk about that in just a little bit. In verse 31, in the meanwhile, his disciples prayed him, saying, Master, eat. So they said, Jesus, okay, listen, you got done talking with her. We got food. Let's eat. You're tired. You're hungry. They're just trying to look out for Christ. Verse 32, he said unto them, I have meat to eat that ye know not of. Therefore, says disciples one to another, hath any man brought him aught to eat? So Jesus says, hey, listen, hey, I'm full. I'm good to go because of something that just happened. The disciples look at each other and say, hey, how'd he get food? Was there a hot dog vendor come by? Well, what's going on? How did he get something to eat? So once again, they don't get it. That's a recurring theme with the disciples. Verse 34, Jesus said to them, my meat is to do the will of him that sent me and to finish his work. Jesus said, what satisfies me is not to have a full belly, but it is the satisfaction of doing God's will. You know, that ought to be ours. It isn't about money in the bank. It isn't about houses or cars or fame or fortune. It ought to be fulfilling God's plan, God's will for our lives. It ought to be doing our best for Him. That's where we ought to get the same kind of satisfaction, and throw aside those things of earth that we think we need. It ought to be about serving Christ. Now we'll see the task at hand here, 35. Say not ye, there are yet 4 months, and then cometh harvest. Behold, I say unto you, lift up your eyes and look on the fields, for they are white all ready to harvest. Now I'll tell you my joke. I got a joke on this one. I heard Bob Gray, from used to be pastor down at Longview, Texas, tell this one time. He said, here's Jesus. He says, look into the fields, they're wide unto harvest. And said, you know, kind of motions with his hand, the disciples look, and here comes out of town a bunch of men with white turbans on, you know, bouncing out of town coming. So maybe there is a little bit of joke there, a little bit of picture, you know, these guys with white headdresses coming in. Tell you something, and I'll go back to my point I kind of skipped there. You notice the disciples came out of town, they had food. They hadn't bothered to tell anybody the Messiah was sitting out there. Yet this one woman went back into town, and here comes the whole town to come see Jesus. Well, that had to make the disciples feel small. There's 12 of them that just got beat by one lady. Boy, that had to make them feel real good. Verse 36. And he that reapeth receiveth wages and gathers fruit unto eternal life, or to life eternal, that both he that soweth and he that reapeth may rejoice together. Now, we'll see, verse 35, we see the time is now. Look, the fields are ready. Let's get to it. Verse 36, the goal is the fruit no matter who works on it. You know, we got to get past all this gunslinger mentality of when we win somebody, it's another notch on our gun, and boy, we're special. You know, sometimes people are fortunate enough to reap the harvest of others. There are people that God will... there's people that loved ones and family and friends have prayed for, that have witnessed to, and then years later, they'll be won to Christ by somebody just happened to knock on their door. You know, we had a couple just recently join our church. They had a little boy who's, I don't know, about six, seven years old, something like that. And they had been praying and trying to work with him about getting saved. Well, and they've been in churches and stuff. They just happened to recently move to our area, and they came and joined our church. And right before they joined their church, one of the first times he was in our children's church, that little boy got saved. Now, did the workers back in children's church receive a reward for it? Oh, I'm sure they will. But I tell you what, they reaped a harvest that those parents had lovingly sowed and wept over and prepared. It's just they didn't get to reap the harvest, just some workers in Children's Church did. But you know what? Praise God, no matter who did the planting, who did the sowing, the fruit was still gathered in. The souls were still saved. Verse 37, and herein is that saying true, one soweth, another reapeth. I sent you to reap that whereon ye bestowed no labor. Other men labored, and ye entered into their labors. Everybody needs to do their part in reaching this goal. Whether we sow, whether we reap, you know, I tell you, sometimes we get wrapped up into thinking the only way to win souls is doing like door-to-door soul winning. It's only the act of soul winning. I tell you what, though, you want to be a good soul winner, you need to be a good Christian all around town. You need to pay your bills. You need to be kind. You need to be a good person. You need to have a good testimony. Now, is all that, as some people would look down on that, in comparison to the actual act of sowing. But I tell you what, it's all one big thing. It's all interrelated. If you want to be a good sower, you need to be a good Christian. It's not about learning about ways to manipulate people into praying a prayer or something, but you need to just be a good Christian. And how'd I get off on that? Verse 30. So let's go ahead and go on to verse 39. I don't want to get too deep into that. Kind of a little bit off topic. It's a rabbit trail I'd love to take chase, but let's go ahead and get on. Verse 39, and many of the Samaritans of that city believed on him for the saying of the woman, which testified, he told me all that I ever did. So there were many people, many Samaritans, those lowly Samaritans that the Jews hated, a bunch of them believed on Jesus as the Messiah because of the testimony of this woman. What an amazing, amazing deal. 12 disciples couldn't win one, and this lady won a whole town. Wow. Verse 40, so when the Samaritans were come unto him, they besought him that he would tarry with them, and he abode there 2 days. This place that the Jews didn't even want to drive through, Jesus stays 2 days. You know why? Because Jesus saw the need. Jesus saw those people that needed salvation. He gave them salvation. And then he's going to stay with them a couple of days. Wow. Boy, I tell you what, we ought to want Jesus to stay with us too. If you've ever been that place, you think, God, don't let this stop. I don't want this feeling to stop. Whether it's a camp, maybe you've gone to a church camp, thank God, I don't want to go home. Boy, this is great. Maybe it's that revival service, and you think, God, I don't want to go home. Let's have another sermon. Let's have some more songs. This is too good to leave. These people wanted Jesus to stay. Boy, we ought to want Jesus to stay too. Verse 41, and many more believed because of his own word. So these people that didn't believe the woman, they believed when they met Jesus, they believed him. You know what? Sometimes we may not necessarily be able to win them through ourselves and our own power and our own persuasiveness. Sometimes it takes somebody actually meeting Jesus a little bit, falling in love with him to be saved. Verse 40, 41, 42, we'll wrap this up. And many more believe because of his own word. Sorry, I already read that one. Anyway, and said unto the woman, all those people said there, sorry, got confused. That's what I get for trying to read an outline and read the scriptures at the same time. And many more believe because of his own word, and said unto the woman, now we believe not because of thy saying, for we have heard him ourselves, and know that this is indeed the Christ, the Savior of the world. So even more people were saved, not just because, well, think about this. The disciples didn't win anybody. This woman won a whole bunch. And not only did she win a whole bunch, but the further fruits of her action was that many more people got saved too. That many more people came to Christ, not because of her personal testimony, but they couldn't stay away from what was going on. They couldn't ignore it. They had to hear Jesus. They didn't believe that woman, but when they met Jesus, that was enough for them. You know, and that's the thing we need to do. And, of course, verse 43, we'll kind of jump into that. There's already talked about four. Now, after 2 days, he departed thence and went into Galilee. So Jesus was there 2 days. It says that twice. Jesus spent 2 days there reaping a harvest and planting a lot of seed amongst the most downtrodden, looked down upon group of people in the area. But wow, what a revival they had. And it all started because Jesus took his time to talk to one lady. I tell you what, sometimes we get to classifying things as big and small, and we want to do the great things. We want to do things that get the attention. We want to do things that bring in the great results. Christ took time to talk to one lady and won a town to Christ, brought salvation to a multitude of people because he talked to one person. You know, history is full of stories about little kids that come to church, and because of one Sunday school teacher, they find the love of Christ, they find salvation, and then they go on to become great preachers. Lee Robertson has a testimony like that. Jack Hiles kind of had a testimony like that, if I remember right. And all those people just took a little time to meet with one person, spent a little time with one person, and boy, later on, look at the fruits of their labor. I think of course, one of the most famous is D.L. Moody. And Mr. Kimball, the Sunday school teacher, went to go talk to him, was too scared to go in. D.L. Moody's working as a clerk in a little shoe store. And finally, Mr. Kimball prayed and said, God, if you'll get everybody out of there, I'll go in and talk to him. And Mr. Kimball goes in there and shared the gospel with the young man who had visited a few times in his Sunday school class, won him to Christ. How could Mr. Kimball know that little boy, that young man, that teenager, selling shoes, would turn two continents upside down for Christ? Who would win? I've heard a million souls. How would he know that? How could he possibly know that? He didn't. But he talked to the one person he could. Christ talked to the one person he could, and a lot of stuff happened. I thought, too, just now, the testimony of Spurgeon is very similar. Spurgeon was on his way to a church. If I remember, I may get all these details right. Spurgeon's on his way to a church, happens to duck into a Methodist, small Methodist church. It's snowing, blizzard outside. I don't remember. I don't think he was even intending to go to this church, if I remember right. I may be wrong on that. But he goes and sits up kind of in the little balcony area and kind of hiding back there, doesn't know anybody. And a guy gets up to preach who wasn't even the pastor of the church, evidently, a lot of legend about it, but was either just like a layman in the church or just a preacher just happened to be passing through. It's an evening service. It's blizzard conditions outside, yet this guy gets up and preaches the gospel, and Spurgeon gets saved. And look at the impact he had. Well, we could go on and on and on. And I tell you what, you've probably got people in your own life that are that way, that took some time to spend with you to share the gospel, or just to help you be a better Christian, to strengthen your walk with God. And look what they did. That's something I like to take away from this. Those disciples, 12 of them, couldn't win a single person. They just went and got their food. But Jesus talked to the one outcast lady, and she ends up going back, sharing the good news that she had experienced, that she had found, and a multitude of people were saved. What a story, what a story. I know, boy, this is long. We're pushing an hour. Just, wow, that's a long time. And I appreciate you listening, sticking through it. I hope it's been a help and a blessing to you. We'll catch you again in the next lesson. Thanks for listening.